Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Michael Suarez. I'm the director of Rare Book School. It's a great privilege to have you here. I met this evening's speaker at a conference in June of 2009. And somewhat to my embarrassment, I had been asked about 2.5 or 3 years earlier, would I speak at a conference being sponsored by French and English intellectual property attorneys about the impact of copyright. It was a conference to mark the 300th anniversary of the passage of the Act of Queen Anne. And I was asked to comment on the effect that the passing of the statute had on book trade practice. And in the audience were QCs and high court judges. In the audience were the copyright experts from the Library of Congress. In the audience were a group of French intellectuals and attorneys who may have been intellectuals, it wasn't clear to me. As this first morning went on, there was a young man in the audience who kept not only asking the best questions, but answering the questions that some of the speakers and panelists could not answer. And that man was our speaker tonight. And by lunchtime, he was the rock star of the conference, even though he was only there as an audience participant. Tomás Gómez Oresteguy is an associate professor of law at Lewis and Clark Law School in Portland, Oregon. He's worked there for the last 6 years, but this year he's visiting associate professor at George Washington University School of Law, which you will know is in D.C. His interests are primarily in the history of intellectual property, especially the history of copyright law before 1800. He's interested in the remedies awarded in intellectual property cases. And his scholarship has been described by many as groundbreaking. There are a number of hugely impressive, lengthy, and archivally documented articles in some of the best law journals in the field, with titles like The Untold Story of the First Copyright Suit Under the Statute of Anne, or Prospective Compensation in Lieu of a Final Injunction in Patent and Copyright Cases, or the one that was the foundation of my own research, What History Teaches Us About Copyright Injunctions and the Inadequate Remedy at Law Requirement. Tomás knows more about early copyright law than any living person in the world. And it's a sham that he wasn't invited to this conference, and I told him at the time that I was about to become the director of Rare Book School, and if the board of directors didn't throw me out in a timely fashion, I would make sure that he came down and lectured at the University of Virginia on his subject. He is an archive rat. There are few people in the world who know the ins and outs of the Public Record Office, now the National Archive, as well as he does. And what you're going to hear today is deeply rooted in archival research and the nuanced interpretations that he's able to give it by his intimate familiarity with the field. Tomás maintains an online database of copyright infringement suits and actions from about 1560 to 1800. And he's a graduate of the University of California and the University of Oslo, where his LLM is from. After law school, he had two clerkships, then went into practice, and then eventually became a law professor. Ladies and gentlemen, you are in for a treat. There will be no torts this evening. Please join me in welcoming our speaker.
No pressure. Well, that was a very, very, very kind introduction. I know that you do not deserve it. Thank you so much for inviting me, Michael, and the Rare Book School. It truly is a privilege to be here. I had learned of the Rare Book School even as a law professor, because there is a tremendous amount of intersection between the work I do and the work that book trade historians do and bibliographers as well. So thank you again for having me here. I really appreciate it. So as the title here indicates, my lecture this evening is about the origins of Anglo-American copyright law. And it addresses in particular whether copyright existed at common law in England before 1710, which is the year the first modern copyright statute, the Statute of Anne, was enacted. I will discuss new evidence of lawsuits filed before 1710, which indicate that judges sitting in equity courts believed that there was such a thing as a common law copyright. These suits are significant for two reasons. First is because legal historians have assumed that they didn't exist. The conventional view has been that suits enforcing a common law copyright arose only after the statutory terms of the newly enacted copyright statute had begun to expire in the 1730s. Second, the cases are especially important because the origin of copyright has been under question in recent years by scholars who promote a narrow view of the nature and scope of that right. The main objective of these scholars has been to demonstrate that copyright was not originally a creature of the common law, but was instead a privilege created solely by statute. As I'll explain shortly, the principal goal of my research has been to examine that line of scholarship, and as it turns out, based on what I found, to rebut it. And notably, although my work concerns legal doctrine and by and large depends on legal records, it has been very much informed by evidence gleaned from outside those records. Indeed, many of my inferences and conclusions depend on practices of the book trade before 1710, and in numerous instances on facts revealed or suggested by the bibliographical record. Excuse me. I should also note that my remarks today are based on a work that is still a work in progress. Nevertheless, as I have already completed most of my research, my findings that I'm presenting this evening are certainly well beyond provisional. Not quite firm convictions just yet, but they're getting there. Now, before we continue, let me just say a little bit about what I mean by copyright at common law. As to its source, first of all here, a copyright at common law is a copyright that exists as a matter of custom and without need of a statute, other regulation, or a patent to support it. A copyright at common law is also a right that would be recognized in a court of common law. Thus, even though nearly all of the cases that I have uncovered are from courts of equity, which sometimes departed from the common law, my thesis is that they are nevertheless probative of a copyright that would be expressly recognized at common law if and when a common law court had the opportunity to do so. Let's look at scope. Copyright common law also has a scope dimension with two possible meanings. The first is that an author or her assigns has a right to prevent the unauthorized first publication of a work. This is sometimes called the right of first publication. The other sense of the term is that an author or her assigns has a right at common law after lawful first publication to control further publication and exploitation of the work. It is this second sense that my presentation today is mostly concerned with. So why does this history matter? Why should we care about about copyright cases that are over 300 years old and whether they might have recognized or applied a copyright at common law? I will admit that in the United States, at least, there are only a few areas where it could directly influence copyright doctrine, and some of those are to this day even actually being whittled away. Instead, the chief reason that English copyright law of this vintage remains important today is because it currently plays a supporting role in normative arguments over the nature and proper scope of American and British copyright law. At the heart of the debate is whether to treat copyright more like a natural right or property right on the one hand, or as a privilege that was created solely by statute. These viewpoints carry hefty baggage because they set the default basis of copyright law. Was and is copyright's primary rationale to protect authors and their assigns in their works, or was it designed principally to promote the public interest? Depending on which side one comes out on this issue, it can affect how one defends or attacks various issues, including things such as whether to continue to enlarge the statutory term of copyright beyond where it stands now, which at the moment in the United States and pretty much everywhere else is the life of the author plus 70 years, or whether, for example, to resurrect statutory formalities for obtaining copyright. There were formalities previously in this country, things, procedural things you had to jump through in order to get a copyright. That law that ended up changing in 1989. There are other issues as well. Now, the traditional view on the historical question, at least with respect to English law, was that the origin of copyright in published works was as a common law right that predated the statute. This view was gleaned from two reported cases. The first was Millar v. Taylor, a King's Bench decision from 1769, which held 3-1 that a common law right predated and survived the Statute of Anne, meaning that copyright was a natural right of authors and that it was perpetual. The second decision was Donaldson v. Becket from the House of Lords in 1774, which overturned Millar in a split decision. Though the Lords did not specifically decide whether there was a common law right that predated the statute, a majority of the judges who had advised the Lords opined that a common law right did exist before 1710, but that the statute had preempted it. That meant that once published, a copyright in a work would only last as long as the statute permitted. And notably, both of these decisions here relied in large part on decisions from the equity courts that had been decided after 1710, which is a point I'll come back to in just a moment. This traditional view has actually been under attack for some time. In 1983, Howard Abrams, a law professor at the University of Detroit, wrote an article in which he argued that Donaldson had been misinterpreted. According to Abrams, the opinions expressed by the peers in Donaldson demonstrate that the House of Lords actually held that copyright had never existed as a right of common law. He was able to plausibly argue as much because Donaldson was reported in several places inconsistently, thus leaving the case susceptible to more than one interpretation. Moreover, during the last 8 years or so, Ronan Deasley, a law professor at the University of Glasgow, has taken the argument further. He has buttressed Abrams' work with innovative primary research at the National Archives and elsewhere. Importantly, this modified account has been quite influential. Although historians of the book trade have been more skeptical, many copyright scholars in the United States have adopted the modified account, including most notably David Nimmer and Bill Patry, who are the authors of the two major and most influential treatises on copyright law. We are thus, at the moment, in the midst of a monumental shift in our understanding of the origins and nature of copyright law. My work, on which this evening's lecture is based, seeks to return our understanding of the origin of copyright law to where it was before, right? As a right that inured to authors and their assigns at creation and survived publication. My work attempts to do so in two ways. The first is to challenge the way that Abrams and Deasley have read and interpreted that Donaldson decision. I'm not going to bother you with that this evening. Rather, the second way that I challenge this is by looking and challenging at an underlying assumption made by these modern scholars and by skeptics of the common law right from the 18th century, and that was that there were no copyright lawsuits filed before 1710, whether in courts of common law or courts of equity. Of course, naturally, that's what I'm going to spend the rest of my time talking about. Now, before we look at these cases, let's take a moment to discover how this historical error or assumption came about. As we'll see in just a moment, there's nothing really magical about it. It was a consequence of the passage of time combined with some unfortunately erroneous pronouncements made by some of the most eminent lawyers and judges of the 18th century. So when the Statute of Anne was enacted in 1710, the statute offered authors of books first published after its effective date a potential copyright term of 28 years. Also interesting is that for works that had been published before the statute's effective date, there was a legacy clause that stated that those books were statutorily protected for 21 years, thus until 1731. And for the most part, then, cases that were litigated from 1710 to 1731 did not need the common law because there was statutory protection. Now, after 1731, the common law rights started to matter in certain cases, and there were a handful of common law-based suits that were filed in the Court of Chancery in the 20 years or so after 1731. And these were all on works that had previously been protected by the Legacy Clause. Now, in all of these suits, the plaintiffs obtained some type of interlocutory injunction. Okay? But the suits never went to a final hearing or decree. That's to say, they never actually went all the way to trial. Indeed, in most of the cases, the lawsuit terminated quite quickly. The plaintiff obtained a form of interlocutory injunction known as an injunction until answer, which meant that it would last until the defendant put in a full and perfect answer to the lawsuit. It just so happens that in those instances, the defendant did not answer at all and acquiesced, so those suits were over fairly quickly. There was another case filed in 1750 or thereabouts where there was an injunction extended a little bit beyond that, and that was until the hearing of the cause, that is to say the trial in equity. But then after that, nothing else happened in the suit either. So that's what was going on right around 1730. Now, by the time the judges decided Millar in 1769 and the judges and peers heard Donaldson in 1774, the judges who believed in a common law right based their decisions in large part on those post-1731 cases, in spite of their deficiencies. But given that they were about 60 years removed from the Statute of Anne of 1710, lawyers and judges believed that there were no cases before 1710. Right? If they knew, they forgot. But my guess is most of them didn't know at all. So let's take a look, and here's our eminent judges and lawyers and so on making the erroneous pronouncements. Before the Statute of Anne created statutory copyrights in 1710, the proprietors of copies, in other words, copyrights, had no idea a bill in equity could be entertained but upon letters patent adjudged to be legal. A bill in equity in any other case had never been attempted or thought of. That is to say, the lawsuits before 1710, of which the judges were aware, right, were all suits brought by patentees. Those are persons or entities that base their claims on exclusive printing rights that the Crown had granted by letters patent, right? They didn't think there was anything other than cases based on letters patent. Let's take a look at Chief Justice Mansfield, Chief Justice of the King's Bench, who made a similar observation in that same case, stating that it had not occurred to litigants before 1710 that a bill would lie for an injunction and relief in equity. Also revealing, I think, is a statement that he made in Thompson v. Collins, a prior case discussing the same issue, where he very candidly admitted that he did not remember from his own notes any law in point of time before the year 1709, excuse me, or thereabouts, or 1710. Now, obviously, the lack of pre-1710 precedents was not enough to affect the outcome in Millar, as the King's Bench had held 3-1, that a common law copyright did exist before the statute. Excuse me. But the historical lacuna was also noted in Donaldson v. Becket, particularly, and it was very much stressed, by the opponents of the common law copyright. So, for example, Chief Justice DeGray in Donaldson v. Becket made a point of highlighting the fact that no bill in equity for an injunction is to be found before the statute. The truth is, the idea of a common law right in perpetuity was not taken up till after the expiration of the legacy term of the statute of Anne. Several other judges and some lords agreed as well. We can see here's Baron Iria, an antecedent common law right was never hinted at in the Chancery cases. And then you can see Lord Camden, who was probably the most vocal opponent of common law rights. Here's what he said. Between 1695 and 1710, no action was brought, no injunction obtained, although no illegal force prevented it. A strong proof that at that time there was no idea of a common law claim. Now, the absence of a string of pertinent cases before 1710 helped him and other skeptics conclude that a common law right was an invention, right? Pressed into service only again after it was clear that the legacy clause would not be enlarged. So let's see how wrong they were. All right, so let's start with just an overview. I have found in the National Archives right now 20 cases brought in equity courts, and actually one case, related case, brought in a court of common law during the relevant time periods. Now, I must be intellectually honest and tell you that we should probably whittle it down to 18 because two of the lawsuits, as you can see here, these are pairs. They're basically based on the same acts of infringement. They just happen to be filed separately against different defendants. Now, none of these cases appear in the nominant reports. That is to say, these lawsuits were not mentioned in any published reports of court decisions, either in the 18th century or even today. Indeed, these cases appear to have been lost to history entirely, with one notable exception. Joyce Brodowski, a librarian and bibliographer, found and discussed 10 of these cases to varying degrees in her unpublished DLS dissertation in 1973. It's a work that unfortunately has not received the attention in legal circles that it deserves. So Ms. Brodowski was able to point me in the right direction for 10 of the cases, but she was unable to find all of the records for those 10 cases. And I have since been able to fill in the gaps on the cases that she already mentioned. I found the other 10 cases over the course of more years of research than I would like to admit. But in any case, I do want to highlight a couple of other things which you might find interesting. Apart from finding the cases and identifying that they're actually relevant cases, that's difficult. But the other thing that is incredibly difficult oftentimes is piecing the suits together. Unlike today, where a lawsuit has all of its records stored together, that would be the pleadings, the proofs, the court orders, and so forth, that's not how things operated at this time. These types of documents, pleadings, proofs, court orders, etc., were stored by document type depending on the office of the court that managed those classes of documents. So that means that when I try and piece these things together, I'm searching in various parts, all at the National Archives, not like I'm jumping around buildings necessarily, but I'm having to search in different areas, oftentimes with either no indices or very rudimentary ones. Now, even in cases where I'm confident that I've found all the extant legal records, I'm not always sure of the final resolution of the case because it's quite common, not just in these cases, but in lawsuits even of the 18th century, for the records to just sort of stop, right? And that's oftentimes because the parties reach some type of accommodation. And this is one of those places where bibliographical records have been of assistance to me. Oftentimes I'll find clues sometimes in the books themselves, in a preface, for example, where one printer or publisher might mention a lawsuit and perhaps even its outcome. And then, of course, as publishers were wont to do back then, they would advertise sometimes the outcomes of their disputes in the press. which I found many instances they've actually come out and say that, or sometimes even not in the term catalogs per se, but in what's the Biblioteca Antiqua, or maybe I pronounced that incorrectly, but some of these other trade magazines where sometimes they would discuss disputes, including some of these, actually, including some of these. I was able to figure out what happened because of that. Now, as you can see here, nearly all of the cases were filed in the Court of Chancery, which was the principal court of equity in England, but two of the lawsuits toward the bottom there were filed on the equity side of the Court of Exchequer, which at the time had a concurrent jurisdiction with the Court of Chancery. So basically, Court of Chancery and Court of Exchequer here really weren't that different. I'm also pleased to report, you can see at the top, that one of the lawsuits that I had found in Chancery before, I very recently found just a couple weeks ago that it was also filed in the King's Bench, which is a court of common law. Unfortunately, it did not go to judgment. That case also just sort of dropped away. The fact that the plaintiff died right around that time is probably the key explanation for that. But in any case, so you might ask yourself, why are all of these lawsuits being filed in a court of chancery and not in a court of common law? And that's because of the relief that these various courts could grant. If you filed in a court of equity, court of chancery, or court of exchequer, the court was empowered to grant an injunction, right? And that is to say an order that prevents someone from doing something, such as printing a book or selling a book that's already been printed. Courts of common law could not do that. What a court of common law would do is give you retrospective relief. They would give you damages for harms that had already occurred. They would not give you prospective relief, right? They could not order someone to stop doing something. And that explains why these lawsuits are almost universally brought in a court of equity. I think you can also see, you can also see from that chart, which I've now made disappear, that these lawsuits were all filed and based upon infringements occurring between 1679 and 1685, or 1695 and 1710. Those dates are important. I have excluded the periods before 1679 and between 1685 and 1695, because those were periods during which a different earlier form of copyright protection existed by statute, which was the Printing Act of 1662. The Printing Act was largely about pre-publication censorship, but it also supported a system of copyright registration administered by the Company of Stationers, which of course was the guild to which most printers and booksellers belonged. The Printing Act lapsed and then expired. And during these statutory lapses, the registration system of the Company of Stationers no longer had the support of statute. And the guild regulations that replaced it, that replaced the statute, were enforceable, if at all, only against other members of the Company of Stationers. Take a look again at our list. Now, I wish I had a silver bullet, right? I do not. None of these cases actually reached a decree or a judgment, but that's not unusual in copyright cases. Even in cases after the statute of Anne, the vast majority of them don't ever actually reach a decree. They just oftentimes didn't make any sense. If a plaintiff was able to get that injunction at the very beginning of the case, oftentimes, like today, in fact, that would suffice. Excuse me. The lawsuits vary greatly in how far along they proceeded. You can see here one lawsuit records only a bill of complaint, but all the others at least had some response from the defendant. At the long end here, we can see that four of the suits lasted around a year, and one lasted nearly 2 years, and another just over 2 years. Right? Now, those time spans, of course, represent start and end dates and do not indicate how active the cases were. Some were very active, but some were not, right? Now, from what I've been able to gather, many of these suits apparently settled. The parties reached some type of accommodation. And importantly, as far as I can tell, none of these cases terminated on the ground that there was no copyright at common law. I've not seen anything like that. Now, most of these suits are against defendants that live in London or Middlesex, but two stretch as far as Cheshire, and from what I've been able to discover, it looks like the two suits involving Cheshire booksellers are some of the earliest examples in the principal courts of England of London booksellers extending their litigious reach, right, outside of the metropolis, putting aside Oxford. There were some cases involving the university and their printing press in the 17th century. Now, as for the basis of these lawsuits, we have these lawsuits. What are they based on? Is it truly common law copyright, or is it a guild regulation or something else? And drawing that type of conclusion is often required interpretation on my part. Now, to be sure, in many of the suits, it's easy, because they expressly state that they're relying on a common law copyright, or the laws and customs of the realm. That's very much the common law. Other times, they tell me that they're relying on the custom of the city of London, for example. But other suits do not expressly state the legal basis of their claim. Instead, the plaintiffs will say something like, I have a property right in the work, or I have a copyright in the work. And if you'll bear with me, I'd like to just do a little side note, because I found this interesting, and I hope you will too. I think it bears highlighting here that these lawsuits are actually chock full of the use of the word copyright, and sometimes in two parts, copy and right, and other times as a conjoined term. And copyright here was a spin-off of the predecessor term, which was the word copy alone. The problem with the word copy was that it had two connotations. One was the original copy, the actual manuscript itself. So if I use the word copy, I might be referring to that. And then the second use of the word copy might actually also mean the intangible right in a work of authorship. So the word copy was used in those two ways around this time. What's fascinating is that here in these lawsuits, we see that the litigants are actually coining the word copyright. Right? They're actually using it in a way to distinguish it from the original manuscript. Excuse me. And what I've also found in some of these suits is you can see the transition happening because they're actually defining the term in the pleadings. Right? So they'll use the word copyright, and then they'll define it immediately afterwards, which obviously indicates that not everyone was familiar with the term. The other thing that I found fascinating is that the word copyright then suddenly suffered a premature death. Right? Tons of people in the book trade are using the word copyright before the Statute of Anne in 1710. And then suddenly it goes away, right? It goes away. And we don't see regular use of the word copyright. We see some sporadically from time to time in the mid-1730s or thereabouts, but we really don't see regular use of it again until 1760s or thereabouts. And in fact, the OED places the first use of copyright, attributes it to Justice William Blackstone in his Commentaries on the Laws of England in 1767. So much as these lawsuits themselves were forgotten, it's interesting, I think the word copyright was forgotten and didn't come back into circulation until much later. So let's come back to our lawsuits. Now, one of the goals of my research, of course, has been to show, often through interpretation and elimination, that these suits were based on a common law right as opposed to some other form of regulation, such as the bylaws of the Company of Stationers. Right? excuse me. You can see my interpretation here summarized in the chart. It's almost all common law copyright. There's one suit in 1685 which straddled the resurrection of the Printing Act, so there might be some statutory component there. But you'll see also that five of the lawsuits expressly relied on the custom of the City of London, and one at the end actually ended up relying on both. Why these suits chose to invoke the custom and the others did not, it's not clear from the records. I do find it fascinating that in the Keble v. Only, you can see right there where they invoke custom of City of London both. In the second lawsuit, they then broaden the basis of the claim to extend beyond the custom of the City of London, to extend to the common law of the entire realm. And what's really interesting, and I don't have an image of it, unfortunately, with me, is that they did it by interlineation, so sort of as an afterthought, like, no, let's base this on the common law in its entirety. Now, One of the things that I've had to grapple with, of course, is that the custom of the City of London is not the custom of the entire realm, right? You cannot say that a city custom is the same thing as the common law. Nevertheless, there certainly are precedents of city customs influencing the common law, oftentimes much earlier in this period. And moreover, the law merchant, which was essentially a law of customs, not limited to any particular place, also infiltrated the common law. So my guess is, from what I've discovered, is that I wouldn't be surprised if judges in the late 18th century considered these cases involving the custom of the City of London as potentially probative of the common law, especially when you consider that the City of London, of course, had been the central place for printing, from 1476 or thereabouts in England. So let's take a look at some of the actual cases themselves. I'm not going to walk through all 20, but what I'm going to do here, of course, is just highlight, I think, about four or five of them. Actually, a little bit more than that, but some we can do all at once. Excuse me. Now, I framed the cases for purpose of this presentation under two objections that had been made to some of the equity suits from 1731. So folks who opposed a common law right, some of them criticized those post-1731 equity cases and said those aren't actually probative of right. So one of the things that those skeptics argued was that the post-1731 decisions had provided very little opportunity for the chancellor in the Court of Chancery to actually consider the case. Because again, there was a bill that was filed, bill of complaint, an injunction was granted, usually ex parte, never heard from the defendant, case went away. Now, that, as it turns out, was not always the case in the lawsuits that I studied. And in fact, in many cases, it very much was not. There was a lot of deliberation going on. So let's look at our first case. Chiswell versus Lee, filed in November of 1681. In this lawsuit, the plaintiff, a bookseller named Richard Chiswell, claimed to have purchased in 1679, directly from the author Gilbert Burnet, the copyright of the History of the Reformation of the Church of England. Notably, Burnet did not assign his copyright unconditionally to Chiswell. Rather, Burnet still held an interest in the book, what today in the U.S. we would call a beneficial ownership in the copyright, as Burnet was to receive royalties from Chiswell from all future impressions. Fast forward a couple of years to 1681, when Chiswell was informed that a bookseller named Samuel Lee and others were about to publish their own version of the book. So Chiswell sued, and you can see this is the bill of complaint, and within 5 days of filing the lawsuit, he moved, as was usual, for an injunction to last until the defendants had put in a full and perfect answer. Notably, in this instance, the request was heard inter partes, meaning that both parties were present during the argument, which was unusual because oftentimes at this early stage, when a plaintiff moved for an injunction like this, it was ex parte, meaning the defendant was not actually present. Here we can see a close-up of the bill of complaint. You can actually see here's the word copyright, and they define it copyright or sole right of printing, and sorry, I cut it off, but this is just an instance of that occurring. Now the court, after it received this request, granted the injunction, and interesting, just a little anecdote, an affidavit in the case indicates that Chiswell told some witnesses that he hoped to have the defendants all in jail, or words to that purpose. The defendants then answered, claiming that their forthcoming book differed materially from the plaintiff's. Indeed, they argued that the book constituted an abridgment of Burnet's book, and being that it was an abridgment, they believed it was lawful for them to print it and sell it. Now, those of you who are well-versed in the practices of the book trade will know that abridgments were fairly common during this period and afterward as well. But as far as I'm aware, this is the first lawsuit in the Superior Court of England that invokes fair abridgment as a defense to a claim of copyright infringement. Now, what happens next is actually quite fascinating. After hearing from both sides, and there was some banter back and forth for a little bit, the Lord Chancellor ordered the defendants to deliver a copy of their book to Dr. Burnett, right? So that he, the author, could compare them and certify whether they were the same or not. Notably, the court, in doing so, seems not to have harbored serious doubts about whether the plaintiff could hold a copyright in the work, as no mention of that issue is made whatsoever. Unfortunately, as tends to happen, the case records then fade out after about a month of some further activity, but one of the last notations in the record states that the chancellor had ordered the injunction continued because the defendant still had not fully answered the plaintiff's complaint. Now, the bibliographical record, in turn, indicates that the defendants had acquiesced, as I was able to find no record in the English short title catalog of them having ever published their abridgment. Dr. Burnett, on the other hand, published his own abridgment soon after, right? And he alluded to the dispute in the preface of his new book, where he explained why he had abridged his own work. He said, "I understood that another was about this, which made me resolve on doing it myself, for none can so truly comprehend, and by consequence abridge any book, as the author himself, who, as he knows his own meaning best." Now, the legal record is susceptible to more than one interpretation, but obviously I think you can sense which one I prefer. To me, it certainly seems probable that the Lord Chancellor believed that there was a copyright in the work. For one, the defendants did not argue otherwise, right? By invoking fair abridgment, the defendants effectively conceded that Chiswell held a copyright. This point cannot be overstated. It would not have been difficult to respond that Chiswell held no copyright at all, but not one of the defendants, and there were three defendants in this lawsuit, chose that route. Instead, the lawyers for both sides seemed to agree that there was a prima facie right. Also telling, of course, is the fact that the Lord Chancellor referred the case to Dr. Burnett to compare the books. It is unlikely that he would have done so if he had harbored doubts about the copyright, which is a point that I think will become more clear in these next lawsuits I want to talk about. So, four of my lawsuits before 1710 involved works that were published anonymously, supposedly by the same author. They are The Whole Duty of Man, The Gentleman's Calling, and The Causes of Decay of Christian Piety. Although scholars today generally agree that the author was Richard Alastair, the authorship of these works was a closely guarded secret. Now, within our universe of pre-1710 cases, two of these four cases actually had the poorest outcomes, and that's because the court refused to enjoin the defendant. I will not recount all the details here, it would take too long, but it's important to note that the Lord Chancellor considered the plaintiff's claims quite carefully, right? And, in my view, the hurdle was not that there could be no copyright in the works, but that the anonymity of the author is what caused problems of proof in the chain of title, right? The defendants, as it turns out in these cases, had actually denied the plaintiff's title to the copyrights, and they doubted whether the plaintiff himself actually even knew who the author was. So the idea being here, you cannot prove that you actually purchased the copyright from the author because you do not know who the author is. So this led, and don't worry, that's not a pen. That is a mechanical pencil with the tip retracted, I promise. excuse me. This led to the court dissolving a previously granted injunction in the first case and then refusing to grant an injunction in the second. These are the minute books. These are actually written in court as the judge is speaking, and I'll just read this. It says, "Blackerby prays the like rule to make the order absolute. Sir Francis Winnington for the defendant." That's one of the attorneys. "Master Solicitor General for the plaintiff. The defendant confesses the plaintiff is entitled to the copies and that the property is the plaintiff's," which the defendant actually had not confessed. And then the court ended up saying, "I refuse to," at the bottom, "will not interpose as to the whole duty of man," and so forth. So this is the judge refusing actually to grant an injunction. Now, the court ultimately ordered the plaintiff to go to law to prove that he actually owned the works. You can see there's an order there, and this is from the minute book. excuse me. And that was essentially what ended up happening in these cases, and then they died out. Now, once again, there is some room here for interpretation. On the one hand, we could interpret the court's reluctance to grant or continue an injunction as a concern that there is no copyright at all here, or simply that the court was concerned more about proof of the ownership of a copyright. Now, based on the actual records, many of which, unfortunately, I don't have time to show you, I've concluded that it is the latter, right? And it seems particularly so when you consider the fact that the Lord Chancellor dissolved the injunction in this case on the same day, right, that he ordered Dr. Burnett to compare the books in Chiswell versus Lee. The lawsuits were filed at the same time, argued by the same attorneys, and literally that order, I don't have it here, they were argued one after another. So he's dissolving one injunction in one case, and he's continuing it in another and asking the author to compare the works. To me, that's fairly conclusive about how the Lord Chancellor felt about it. Excuse me. Now, I've got a few minutes left. I'm probably in about another 10 minutes and then open it up for questions if that's all right. So let's take a look at our next group of cases. And these fall under another objection that one might raise to some of these equity cases. And that, of course, is that, you know what? These really aren't being brought on the common law. Instead, they're being brought on the guild regulations of the company of stationers. And I've heard many people suggest that other times that I've presented this paper. And I've seen it mentioned in literature. Obviously, they weren't talking about these cases as they did not know about them. You know, this is an argument, you know, that maybe it was based on guild regulations that might plausibly be made, but for the fact that, of course, the guild regulations could not apply to non-members at this time, non-members of the company of stationers. And in many of the 20 lawsuits, the defendant was not a member of the company of stationers. In Chiswell v. Lee and Paulett v. Lee, the principal defendant, Samuel Lee, was a member of the company of haberdashers. He was not a stationer. And there are other reasons, which I'll be happy to talk about later, as to why guild regulations could not have formed the basis of the suit. So let's take a look at another one, similar grounds here. Wellington v. Levy, another such case where the defendant was not a member of the company of stationers. This one was filed in February of 1709, which was 14 months before the Statute of Anne. The book at issue was Claude Mauger's French Grammar, which was first published in 1656. The plaintiff, Richard Wellington, claimed to own the copyright by virtue of an assignment made by another bookseller to him in 1698. That's what he alleged in the complaint. The defendant, James Levy, was a bookseller, but as I noted, not a member of the stationers. And in late 1708, Levy began to advertise a new book called The Royal French Grammar, which he published in probably around December of 1708. Wellington sued, alleging that Levy's book was essentially the same despite the difference of title. And 2 days after filing, Wellington moved ex parte for an injunction until answer from the court. And this is how Lord Chancellor Cooper summarized Wellington's claim. The plaintiff alleges that he is, by purchase, for a valuable consideration, possessed of, and as he is advised, legally entitled unto the original copy, which I interpret to mean the manuscript, and copyright, and then they have to define it, or sole propriety, right, of the book called or entitled Claudius Mauger's French Grammar. The Lord Chancellor granted this injunction and then gave the defendant notice and an opportunity to appear and show cause against it, but the defendant, for whatever reason, declined to do so. 2 months later, Levy answered the lawsuit, and in his answer he made two principal arguments. The first was that he argued the plaintiff could have no copyright at common law, right? Stating that books could only be protected by letters patent. So here's a direct challenge to a common law copyright. Second, Levy argued that his book differed materially from Wellington's. Though he admitted to extracting parts of Wellington's book, Levy claimed that his Royal French Grammar had been compiled from several other French grammars as well. You know, not something you really wanted. I stole from everyone. Yeah, yeah. So it wasn't just you. Now, when the case came before the Lord Chancellor again on the issue of whether to continue the injunction to the hearing, the court did not mention this dispute or argument over whether there was such a thing as a copyright at common law. Indeed, the court seems to have cared more about whether the books were the same, because in December 1709, he referred the case to a master to have him compare the books and determine whether they differed materially. So here's the order. This court doth order that it be referred to Master Fellows, one of the masters of this court, to examine into the matter and to see whether the grammar entitled Claudius Mauger's French Grammar and the grammar entitled the Royal French Grammar, by which one may, oh sorry, that's a long title, right? I'll skip that, be one and the same book and whether they materially differ or not. Unfortunately, I was unable to find the master's report, if any such report was ever made, but I was able to find a document that the master relied upon in reviewing the case. The document is actually the original 1698 copyright assignment to Richard Wellington, right, the one that he mentioned in the Bill of Complaint, from his predecessor in interest of the entire copyright in Claude Mauger's French Grammar. You can see it there. It hasn't been reproduced that well, the blue arrow. There's Mauger's French Grammar, all the entire copies of these books following. I found this document in the National Archives in the exhibit files that once belonged to Master Fellows. This document suggests that in addition to comparing the books, the master was also delving into whether Wellington actually held the copyright in the work. The master thus seems to have assumed that there was a copyright in the work, and maybe the only question being as to who was the actual owner. I hate to sound like a broken record, but I found no other records after the referral to the master in December 1709. But once again, the bibliographical record does offer some clues. The defendant's Royal French Grammar was not printed again until 1720. But when it was printed by the Wellingtons, right? So the defendant basically forfeited the book and handed it over to the plaintiffs. So clearly, I mean, the defendant recognized that he did not have any rights in it. The problem, naturally, is this case is so close to the statute of Anne that it's not clear whether the defendant felt compelled to do so because there was a common law right or because the legacy clause of the statute had then kicked in and they knew that they would be subject to that statute for 21 years. In any case, I think certainly the earlier stages of the suit are interesting and probative. Now, I want to talk about one more, and then I will wrap things up. And this is a very interesting suit as well. It's called Horn versus Baker, which was filed in the Chancery 4 months before the Statute of Anne was enacted. The case is particularly fascinating because Lord Chancellor Cooper was again asked to rule on common law copyright, but this time it was on a demur, right? It wasn't just raised by the defendant in an answer. At issue here was the book Coup de Brasse by Samuel Butler, which was first published in three parts in the 1660s and 1670s. Thomas Horn, our plaintiff, who was a member of the Stationers' Company, he held the copyright in part three. Now, in November of 1709, John Baker, who was a bookseller, published a budget pocket edition of all three parts. You can see this, that's the text there. Obviously, the title page is from the first part. And Baker, like the other defendants, many of the other defendants before him, was not a member of the company of stationers. And in fact, at this time, he was not a member of any guild at all. Later, he became a member of the upholders company. So Horn ended up suing Baker, of course, for violating what Horn argued was a common law copyright. Horn claimed to have inherited the copyright from his deceased father, who had previously purchased the copyright directly from the author, Samuel Butler, in 1679. So here is his bill of complaint, which requested an injunction. But the procedure back then was you wouldn't actually get an injunction unless you moved for it in court. And that's something that he did not do. Perhaps it was because of the impending holidays. This bill of complaint was filed December 15th, 1709. So that might explain it. And then Baker came along. And yes, that's a shortest demur I think I've ever seen, filed a general demur in January 1710, which the Lord Chancellor did not hear until May 1710, which was 1 month after the Statute of Anne was enacted. At the hearing on the demur, These are the court actual minutes from the hearing. Baker's counsel made three arguments. First, Baker admitted that the statute of Anne prohibited him going forward, but he argued that Horn could have no copyright claim because Baker had printed his book before the statute. Second, even if Horn could have an action for the infringement of a copyright at common law, Baker argued that he should not be forced to reveal how many books he had printed, as that would go to proving Horn's damages. And that type of remedy was for the courts of common law to calculate retrospective damages, and for the court of common law to do it without the aid of discovery inequity. And lastly, Baker argued that Horn's lawsuit also requested the disgorgement of Baker's profits, which was a remedy that he argued the Court of Chancery was not empowered to give. Now here, we're fortunate. There actually is a manuscript report of the case, of the argument, which was written by one of Horn's own lawyers. And it shows here that the court granted the demur, but what's interesting is it granted it on grounds 2 and 3, right? The manuscript report and other minutes make no mention of any doubt over whether there was a valid copyright. So here, this is the manuscript report in Lincoln's Inn. And let's see what the court said. The court first rejected the notion that it could award a disgorgement of Baker's profits, stating, to make the defendant account for the profits of what he has sold is going too far. For the injury that the plaintiff has sustained ought to be the measure of damage and not the profit which the defendant has made. So the court's refusing to recognize disgorgement of profits as a remedy here, and instead says, your remedy is essentially actual damages, which, by the way, was a remedy not given by the statute of Anne. If you wanted actual damages, that was a common law. If you wanted penalties, that was the statute of Anne. The court then refused to permit a discovery of Baker's sales and printing arrangements, even insofar as that discovery was to be used at law to recover those ordinary damages. Turns out he thought it odd to allow a person to come to equity to discover the amount of ordinary damages. And here's what he says. Then as to the discovery of what books the defendant has sold and what he has done in respect to his printing of this book is in order to enable you to recover greater damages at law. I don't know that this court ever went so far. Suppose a trespass was done, would you come here against the trespasser to discover how many cattle he put into your land and what damage he has done? And that essentially was all that he ended up saying. Now, a couple of conclusions as to that particular case and then more generally. I think, in my view, given all the manuscript records and reports that I've seen, if the Lord Chancellor truly had some doubts or concerns about whether there would be a copyright, could be a copyright at common law, that manuscript report would have looked very different. I mean, it's very simple to say, I don't think you have a copyright at common law. Instead, the judge waved that argument off, it appears, and moved on to the others. So again, I think that's a case that is probative of a common law right. So I'll stop here. Essentially, you know, what I'm trying to do here is show that our current understanding of the origin of copyright is at best incomplete, and at worst, it's just flat out wrong, right? Quite simply, what we have taken to be true for centuries, that there were no common law copyright cases, or really any copyright cases filed at all other than on patents before 1710. That's just not true. And this can have significance both in the spheres of law and in the studies of the book trade. In law, of course, as I noted at the beginning of my talk, it can have a profound effect on how we talk about the nature of copyright, whether it's a property right or not. And even in our understanding of the book trade, it can have some profound significance. Because, with the exception of Joyce Brodowski and those who have read her work, most everyone has thought that the booksellers before 1710, during the lapses of the Printing Act of 1662, really had no recourse in the principal courts, right? If they had someone who actually infringed their work, they really couldn't do anything about it through the regular legal system. But in any case, I'll just stop here, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Yes, Chris.
Thomas, so we just to tell you, I know Chris Springer, I teach at the law school, so Tomas and I are clear that I do intellectual property law as well, but I'm not a historian. And part of what I want to say quickly relates to a kind of culture clash between what you do and what I do, which is, this is a legal historical project. My specialty is law and economics. So when I think of the relationship between cause and effect, if I can't say something with 95% statistical certainty, I haven't reached a conclusion. Different standards apply here. I understand historical scholarship is to work in a different framework. But a couple of comments. One about your interpretation of cases, and another about how you relate this to what a common law actually means. Mm-hmm. In your interpretation of the cases, I look at a bunch of cases that aren't litigated through the conclusion, and I have a couple of observations. First of all, these are mostly publishers on both sides of the V in these cases, both plaintiffs, defendant. And when I think of publishers talking about common law copyright, I think of foxes talking about a common law right to guard hen houses.
Right.
Right? So I think that when publishers are fighting one another, they may have no wish to deny the existence of a common law copyright. They may disagree over the scope of the common law copyright and whether, for example, it reaches this particular abridgment, or whether there's a license that negates any particular common law claim. But you know, this is a wonderful both feature and problem with the common law, is that often the kind of rules you get depend largely on the kinds of litigants that come before the court in a particular issue. This leads to my point about the common law. So I teach torts, and one of the things that I think is totally fascinating about torts is that if you look back into the actual cases regarding any particular rule, so let me give you an example. There's a rule about children. Are children held to the ordinary standard of care that adults must exercise? The rule typically is thought of, no, they're not, except when they're engaged in adult activities. That's the common law rule. If you look back into the early cases, the courts are all over the place. There are some courts that hold that, there's some courts that hold the opposite, there's some courts that are somewhere in between. And the only way we know about a common law rule is that over a couple of centuries, actually, the higher courts rationalize the law, and they go back, and without ever announcing what they're doing, they kind of clean up the picture for us. Mm-hmm. So the common law is not a neat process. It's a horribly messy process. The messiness is obscured for us later in an act of selective forgetting. So what I'm suggesting to you is it may not be surprising to me that there are some cases before the statute of Anne holding that there's something, although they don't hold this, they don't ever actually say there's a common law copyright,
right,
but suggesting that there might be. And yet, I'm not sure what to make of that. Does that mean there's a common law copyright, or does that mean that this is a snapshot in time that later would have been selectively forgotten? Hmm. When a court like Donaldson versus Beckett says, there's no such thing as a common law copyright, or at least if there was, it doesn't survive publication. So again, what conclusions to draw from this?
Right.
It is a series of questions that I'm left with.
Sure. Let me take your second comment first. What I'm trying to do here in investigating these cases is I'm trying to answer the views of two skeptics. Obviously, the ones that are still alive are the ones that are most important, right? They're either going to agree with me or not. And so, certainly, I'm trying to meet whatever standard modern-day skeptics would have. But quite frankly, my answer is, and again, it won't always fly, is that I really shouldn't have to change what the standard is, right? The standard is whatever the judges of the late 18th century, the ones who are most contemporaneous to these cases, would have thought qualified as proof of a common law right. And the bottom line is the vast majority of the judges in Donaldson v. Beckett and in Mallory Taylor, in both of those cases, thought that cases from the Court of Equity, right, even ones that only resulted in an interlocutory injunction where the defendant didn't even appear, they thought that those were probative of a common law right. And the reason being is that the judge, the Lord Chancellor, even on an ex parte motion, would not have granted that interlocutory injunction unless the judge thought that there was a decent chance here to win. And if you look at, and I apologize, I didn't have time to get into it, this actually, the record bears that out. If you look at the motions in those 1730 cases, they are accompanied by affidavits, sometimes very lengthy affidavits, which are submitted to, number one, show proof of title. I actually own a copyright. And number two, to then show some proof of infringement. You usually submitted affidavits on both of those points, and sometimes more than just two affidavits. And so under the 18th century standard of what they thought was probative, these cases are that and then some. I mean, there's more cases, right, than existed after 1731. And these cases were litigated much more carefully than the cases after 1731. Your first point, yes, it's true that these are not lawsuits involving authors. And that is, I guess, the ultimate holy grail, is to find an author who's suing a publisher. I have found lawsuits like that. But what they're doing is you've got authors who are suing their own publisher. And the reason is I agreed with my bookseller that they would print 1,000 impressions of my book. They printed 2,000. Right. And because we didn't express our agreement in writing, I cannot sue that bookseller in a court of common law. So I sue them in chancery. And I might ask for an injunction, but really what I want is some compensation for the extra 1,000 impressions of the book. But that's not really, I mean, today we might argue whether that's copyright infringement or not, but back then they weren't really complaining about it. I think the reason, not I think, I'm pretty darn sure the reason we don't have authors, at least that we've found so far, there's a case out there somewhere, I'm almost, it's got to be someone out there, someone out there, is because authors sold these things to publishers. If I'm an author and I want to print a book, I can't, right? I mean, it's not like I can hit print on a computer. So I've actually got to someone who has the means, right? A printing press and so forth, typesetters. I mean, this is a pretty robust operation here to do that for me. Now, I can enter into an agreement like Gilbert Burnett did, which was very favorable to the author. That author did not sell his copyright outright to the bookseller. He actually maintained a piece of it. And I have seen, actually, in one of my other lawsuits of the 20, a similar arrangement talked about where the author also retained a piece of the action on the back end. But again, you know, the booksellers are the ones, they're going to litigate these cases. They've invested a lot of money printing the books. They're the ones who are most going to be hurt by a defendant. Yes?
So I'm a literary scholar, so please forgive me if this is quite naive about some of the technicalities of law.
No problem.
But what I was wondering was whether these kinds of cases could be taken by publishers against one another in a place where unauthorized public reprinting is common. So in Ireland in the 17th century, the 18th century, or in the U.S. after 1790. So do these appeals to the common law rely on the presence of an author?
Of an author?
Does the author need to be present? Because in these unauthorized reprinting systems, the agency of the author is completely circumvented, and it's just publishers reprinting works.
I don't think that the author has to. The author does not actually have to physically be alive and present in order to litigate these lawsuits. Does the author play a very important role? Absolutely. In every suit that I have found, the plaintiffs are usually, unless it's a case involving an anonymous author, they're very careful to trace their ownership back to the author. Some of these bills of complaint are 6 feet long because so many booksellers have owned the copyright or a share of a copyright. And so, yeah, the author plays a very important role, even in these publisher-based lawsuits. Absolutely. You've got to trace it back to the author, or it's like it never happened. And that's why I think the Paulette v. Lee cases, that was a real problem in that set of cases.
So does that mean that these kinds of cases are not likely to happen in Ireland in the 1700s or in the U.S. after 1790?
That they're not likely to happen?
The courtesy of the trade suggests that whoever's printing their text first has a kind of de facto copyright.
In Ireland, yeah, sure. Right. I mean, that certainly there was that custom in Ireland. And in England and in London, there were also sort of courtesies that occurred. I mean, and they created the Congers around this time, the expiration of the Printing Act, or the first lapse of the Printing Act of 1662. But, yeah, I mean, I can't offer you any definitive conclusions on it. It's not uncommon in these legal regimes to see more than one type of enforcement mechanism. So you might have a legal right that's granted by statute, and still on top of that, even though you have that, you run out and get a license, a royal license from the Crown, and then maybe get a letters patent on top of that. You don't need any of that, right? If you have one of those bases, we'll do just fine. And then on top of that, you've got the support from the Congress and courtesies and things like that. So yeah, it's it's common to see the overlap, and it's hard, I think, to draw any conclusions from the absence of one of the other. So. Yes?
I guess on your flip side, Chris here, sorry, I'm not a lawyer. And you're telling a largely kind of internalist, formalist story about something that's going on in places called courts before a statute is made. Mm-hmm. And I was struck as you were telling a story. Good Lord, Gilbert Burnett, Judith Roth, Sir Francis Whittington. I mean, these are some of the leading thinkers, works of fiction, and lawyers of the period you're talking about. There are some really fascinating personalities behind every single one of those stories you're discussing. And then I think forward to the 1760s, 70s, where you have these seemingly explicit denials of whatever it was that was known or unknown, perhaps lost in those earlier cases. But then I'm thinking, you know, well, one of these things is in the House of Lords. Well, there's an unusual law-declaring environment. So I guess my question for you is really about the contingency of personality, political relationships. I won't specify, but there's some very interesting things going on in some of the characters appearing in those 1680s cases, and the political religious conflicts of that particular moment strike me as perhaps working behind some of those cases. So that as we think across this century in which you have these figures in the latter part of your story looking back and either actively forgetting or being ignorant of something, if really it's a very different story to be told, that it's not the kind of internalist, formalist account where your focus is.
Yeah, that's a great point, because that sort of gloss I think could be incredibly valuable. I need to explore the relationships and some of these extra legal concepts that you're describing during this period, because we saw something very much like that in the late 18th century, in these cases, Donaldson v. Becket and so forth. There were clashes of personalities, things that actually explained why one judge took a position against another. You think, why are they doing that? Well, it turns out because he absolutely hates this other judge and he was burned in another case. These are things that, you know, you need to know about it. You need to know the context, right? So I have not explored that. I've been so buried in the archives. But no, that's a great suggestion. I'll definitely explore that. Thank you. Yes?
I was wondering if you have any guess as to why, or no conclusive way, why the Hunting Act of 1662 was not extended there? Or?
Yes. The Printing Act of 1662, probably one of the things that was most controversial about it was the fact that it was about censorship, right? It required people to obtain a license, essentially a censorship license, before they published the work, something that obviously is quite onerous. And they found it infringed and violated all the time, but it was really about censorship. And at the time, in 1694, 1695, there was a lot of literature that absolutely rallied against it. But essentially, I would call it free speech literature. That's essentially what it was. There were other things as well relating to the copyright portion of the Printing Act of 1662. Company of stationers, not saints, and sometimes they would enter books in the register of favored pretenders, people who maybe didn't really actually own a particular copyright, and obviously that was frowned upon by other booksellers. And probably the most controversial thing relating to the register, which was supported by the Printing Act of 1662, is registering classical authors. I mean, you know, like Cicero. It's like, I own the copyright. Like, you cannot trace that one back to the author. Forget it, right? And so, yeah, the registration system had become quite controversial at that time. Okay. Thank you very much.
Much to the point. I would be remiss if I failed to thank the Clay Foundation for their co-sponsorship of this lecture. The Clay Foundation and their generosity certainly helped to bring Tomas here. And
in addition, helped to sponsor the reception that follows in the basement of Alderman Libraries in Rare Book School's capacious quarters, where I hope you will join us for, how to say, a collation. But I think Tomas has told us something today, partly about the power of the paleographic eye, partly about the power of the archive, and one of the things that I find so refreshing about your talk is it's terribly free from the dogmatism of interpretation that characterizes a lot of the pronouncements today in the scholarly literature that I know surrounding what Donaldson v. Beckett means or doesn't mean. So I'm very grateful to you for that as well. And we'd like to express our appreciation by giving you a copy of the poster used to advertise your talk. And thank you once again for coming to us.